Books and Sports. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. For each episode of the podcast, we choose an interesting new book on some area of sports, and we talk with the author about that book and about some of the deeper issues in the study of sports. This week's guest is historian Simon Martin. A native of London, Simon has been living for more than a decade in Italy, where he teaches at the American University of Rome. As you'll hear in the interview, Simon was first drawn to Italy to research the history of fascism. He discovered that there had not been an academic study of Italian football under the rule of Mussolini, a time when the Azzurri twice won the World Cup. His thesis on football under fascism became his first book and earned the 2004 Lord Aberdare Prize, presented by the British Society of Sports History. His newest book looks at Italian sport in a broader scope, from the early 19th century through the fascist period and post-war economic boom, down to today, a time when sport, politics, and media have been mixed together to create what Simon calls Berlusconia. His book is titled Sport Italia, The Italian Love Affair with Sport. It was published in 2011 by I.B. Toris. And like Simon's first book, this one was also awarded the Aberdare Prize. According to the judges, Sport Italia is an essential political history of modern sport and the definitive work on the history of Italian sport in the English language. I will add that Simon writes in an accomplished and engaging style, and as you'll hear from the interview, he is also a man of wit. We start our conversation, as is the custom on the podcast, by hearing a bit about the author's background. And to start, I ask Simon what led him to the study of Italian history and a life in Rome.
It was a bit of a mazy dribble. So I'd kind of the academic career had taken me sort of through a master's in Slavonic East European history and politics. I was originally thinking of looking at studying or going down that road of Romanian fascism, which was I was kind of interested in the freaky side of fascism and blood drinking and that sort of thing, which kind of was kind of appealing. But
the League of the Archangel Michael, you were
exactly you, yeah, yeah no I mean Codreanu and those sort of things. But they really quite, I mean, I'd always been interested in fascism and actually, I mean, it was quite a seriously, it was a fundamental sort of course in my undergraduate career at Queen Mary College in London, and I took a course on fascism, and I had no idea that fascism went beyond Hitler, Mussolini, and Franco, and then there was all these sort of funky fascists out in Eastern Europe, in, you know, the Slovakian priests and the Iron Guard and the Arrow Cross in Hungary, and these sort of, it's like, wow, this is kind of interesting. So I had that interest very much in fascism, but the other thing at Queen Mary, in fact, Queen Mary was completely fundamental in my life, in that there was, when I went there, there was also, just reefing through the library one day, I came across a PhD thesis of some years. This was, I mean, I was there in 92 to 95, and it was probably 10 years before that, of a guy who wrote a thesis on football under Franco, and it was under the supervision of Paul Preston. Mm-hmm. And he looked at Madrid as like the Francoist team, which has kind of since been very much sort of kind of refuted, but he also looked at Barcelona and Bilbao and sort of separatist teams. And this was like, for me, this was like kind of fascinating, you know, history. It was history, but he was doing football. It's like, wow, history can actually be kind of interesting. You can do, rather than foreign policy, you can do interesting topics. So that had remained in my mind, but then I went off on this sort of circuitous route and took the MA in Slavonic studies and was looking at studying Romanian fascism, and it didn't work out. And then that got me thinking about this thing about Spain. It always stuck in my mind. I thought, well, I wonder what happened in Italy, and looked at Italy, and I couldn't find anything out. There was nothing. And there was only, all I could find was just standard sort of books on the World Cup. And looking at it, I was like, wow, Italy won the World Cup in 34. They won it again in 38. They hosted it in 34. And I had a little look a little bit further, and then there was a book by Simon Inglis who wrote architectural histories of British football stadiums, and he did one on European football stadiums. And I looked, and in the Italian section, lo and behold, there were a lot of stadiums which were built by the regime. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, okay, I realised there's something going on here, and I can't find out what it is. So that sounds like, well, that's got all the makings of a perfect PhD topic. Mm-hmm. And it took a few years to get funded to do it. I think across the academics in Britain were probably, especially, you know, nearly 20 years ago now, were a little bit suspicious of someone who wanted to look at football. I think it still remains a little bit. I still get classified as a sports historian, which is not that I'm offended by that, but I think it kind of doesn't quite represent what I do and what a lot of so-called sports historians do. You know, I mean, I consider myself an Italianist. I'm an Italian historian. I just happen to look at Italy through the medium of sport. If I did it through opera, then I think I wouldn't be called an opera historian. I would be called an historian. So I think there was an element of sort of kind of, I don't know, it was kind of new, I guess, at the time. I mean, sports history, you know, wasn't, I was breaking the mold. People had been doing it before, but it's obviously over recent years become a lot more in vogue. And that's really what took me to Italy. I went to, and I looked at it was principally the stadiums. I was very interested in architectural, the nature of the stadiums, why they were, the two stadiums of Florence and Bologna, so very, very different. And that's had an impact upon me right up until now. I'm currently teaching a course on Mussolini's Rome, looking at the architecture of Rome, and that comes really from that interest in the different styles of those stadiums. And so having spent a year in Florence, 6 months in Bologna, I then had to go to the Central State Archive, which was in Rome, and I went there for 2 months, and I was done. I was going for 2 months, coming home, finished, go back to London, and like a lot of people, I went there for 2 months, and I'm still there 11 years later, so... That's it. That's how I got to Rome, effectively.
Let's talk about your book on Italian sport. And one of the important themes of the book is the connection of sport to the Italian nation, or the idea of the nation. And this is something I remember being surprised at as a university student, this idea, or the realization, that Italy as a nation state remains, even today, remains a work in progress. So can you talk about how this theme relates to your research and your book?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is a work in progress. It's a good definition in many ways. Although I think a work in progress suggests that one day it might be completed, which I'm not sure. I don't think it ever will. But I think quite simply, I mean, the whole thing about the book in many ways, I mean, I think people... If you look through Italian history, and again, I teach this at the American University of Rome. I basically teach the book where I kind of teach the history of Italy through sport. And the big theme is identity, building the nation. And we spend a lot of time looking at the unification, which is completely the sort of wrong word in many ways. It's a takeover. It's a colonization by Piedmont. So you have an enormously, a very, very big, a big country, a long country, big sort of, you know, areas of, it's very difficult to connect the sort of various cities at the time of the unification as such. So we have lots of very different cultures separated, cultures, identities, economies. It's not a natural country, and it really needs something to bind it together. And various people look for different ways of binding the country together. War seems to be a consistent theory, whereby Gramsci talks about the revolution, the missing revolution, and lots of other people talk about this opportunity to unite people through war. We need a bloodbath. We need to have thousands of Italians who are prepared to lay. Once we have that bloodbath, we can see that they're finally prepared to lay down their life for their country. At which point, then we can go ahead and we can finish the unification. And this doesn't happen. And obviously, Italy's reputation in war, justifiably, is not very good. Every time they get involved in something, it turns out to be a disaster. So war doesn't really work. What other options are there? You could talk about music, but then music is kind of class divisive. Opera certainly has a lots of nationalistic. We look at Verdi and lots of huge amounts of nationalistic messages and elements coming through that. But then if you can't read and if you don't understand opera, then you're excluded from that. What else is there? We can't reunite around a language because we don't have an Italian national language. So I argue in the book in many ways that I think sport is possibly the only glue that can actually hold everybody together, because it isn't class divisive in the sense that sport as a whole cultural phenomenon can in different forms appeal to different people. So it could be that you come out of the factory and go as a working class sort of manual labourer, come out of the factory and go to the football match, or it could be that you're a member of the, you know, the aristocracy and you fence. But either way, although they're very different sports and they are class based, you're still interested in sport. So I think it was potentially the only way that you, one of the only ways you could appeal to all Italians on the basis of being Italian. Now, on the other side of that, it's also very, very divisive, because it is divisive in terms of Italian regionalism, identity, class. It proves difficult to unite people around some champions because they can be divisive as well. We have rivalries, local identities, local heroes. But generally, I think in terms of as a big concept, it's one of the, I can't think of something else realistically that could in theory appeal to all members of Italian society. But it takes the Italians quite a long while to realize this.
Well, and I was going to ask that, was this something that that the monarchy in the 19th century, did they realize the usefulness of sport in their unification, in quotes, their unification project?
Sports, Italian sports origins really are thanks to the monarchy. Pre-unification, sort of 1850s, the king invites a guy called Rudolf Obermann, who has trained, he's Austrian, but he's trained in Germany, and he's got a lot of experience of the Turnen German movement and the way that the Turnen gymnastic movement was used for nationalistic means in Germany against the Napoleonic Empire. So he kind of sees what's happened in Germany, and he invites Obermann to come over and train the Savoy military. And that's really where sort of modern sport enters Italy. Out of this, we see the first real sporting club of Italy, which is the Turin Gymnastic Society. And that's about the sort of, that's from sort of 1840s, 50s onwards. It's through, and then the Gymnastic Society effectively, it starts to spin off and form smaller clubs, which develop throughout the north of Italy. Now, that's about, it's pre-military training. I'm not sure that the king necessarily sees this as a nationalistic tool in the sense of creating identity, but he certainly sees it as a tool to create a fitter, stronger military that will be able to defend his country, which at the time is Piedmont, which then in 1861 obviously becomes Italy. But I'm not sure he really realizes that. I think the first real example of someone who, people who pick it up is the Italian, is the touring club. And in the touring club sort of formed, it's a real national, it really is a nationalist tool. It's an aristocratic, it's always led by sort of formed by aristocrats and sort of members of the upper classes and from based in Milan. And the touring club is that their motto is Far conoscere l'Italia agli italiani, which introduced the Italians to Italy. So it's about letting them, you form this new country and showing to them, showing to particularly northern Italians what their country's about, what's there, what the people are like, and to show them that also that the South, it's not Africa and it's not scary, and the people don't bite down there. And so they form, they start producing maps, guidebooks, and generally encouraging tourism amongst the sort of wealthier classes in the north. And one of the early presidents of the touring club, Luigi Bartarelli, does. He makes a really an account which has been, it's been reprinted, and he goes in the mid 1890s. So roads are non-existent, and he takes a quite an incredible bicycle sort of tour from right down in the south, the southern tip of Italy near Lamezia, up to Eboli, in which is sort of on the way towards Salerno. You know, that would be quite a distance on a bike nowadays, with non-existent roads, which were effectively just tracks, the potential for bandits, the potential for dogs, the heat, everything. That was a pretty tough journey. And what he does is he writes a diary, and they publish it in the newspaper, the Bicicletta, up in the north of Italy. And it's about saying to people, and he literally writes, he does say in this, in one stage of his journal, look, the people down here, they are a bit smelly, they stink a bit, they are different, they're dark, but you know what, they're all right, they're like, they're us, they're not subhuman, so come and explore your country. And in their sort of guidebooks and his writings, and what do they talk about? He literally introduced people to what there is in Italy. They talk about, you know, the various, the major landmarks, the fact that, you know, up in the north of Vercelli, you've got rice fields, you get down to the south, we've got oranges, we've got lemons. People don't know about this. So they, it's really about encouraging tourism, but also about encouraging an association with their country amongst Italians. So I think that's the first real sort of overtly nationalistic kind of sporting movement.
So picking up on this division between the north and the south in Italy, was there a, or what was the difference in the sporting cultures in the north? So talking about the gymnastics movement and the cycling movement, which really began out of the north, was there a sporting culture that, that emerged from the south?
No, I mean, the difference being there is very little. I mean, okay. Italy tends to develop in the north and spread south, so it diffuses. The real sort, the two sporting cultures effectively which operate in Italy are one, nationalistic movement. So you like things like the touring club, but then you also see an enormous amount of sports clubs with nationalistic names. So clubs called Garibaldi, Liberty, names after the king, but it's a overtly nationalistic clubs which are about creating citizen soldiers, which are about creating a real sense of Italian identity amongst its members. Now, the other aspect, the other branch from which modern Italian sport develops is through the oratories, through the church youth clubs. So the church is massively important in the development of Italian sport. And that's obviously very much, well, it's not nationalistic at all, because obviously the church identity is it goes beyond national boundaries. So what you see is that the youth clubs, the church is very smart. I mean, the church always has a consistent fear of sport, but they're smart enough to realize that, okay, but we have to get over this because it's a really useful tool. So youth clubs begin having quite boring gymnastic sort of classes for children. And then when they get a bit, they find that a little bit dull, they start being involved in wanting to play team games. And the church is quite worried about team games. They're particularly worried about football, soccer, because it's an English and Anglo-Saxon invention, and by definition it's Protestant. So they're worried about spreading this, but they also realise that kids want to play football. It's, you know, the new, the football fever, this new phenomenon of the sort of late 19th century. So they embrace it, and they take it on as a way of kind of reaping souls, bringing people into the church. So we'll get them in, they can play football. And then once we got them here, then we'll do some Bible class afterwards. We'll do some religious education. And I think particularly you would see much more of that sort of church influence in the south, where the church was traditionally much stronger. But the development of sport, particularly in the south, is very much it's a diffusion mm-hmm. from the north, effectively. And obviously the big cities. I was going to say industrial cities, but the big cities of the south, which are not that industrial, but nonetheless big metropolises like Naples, Rome, Bari.
So you mentioned the Catholic Church adopting sport as a means of expanding its influence. And another organization that you talk about that sees in the 19th century the usefulness of sport are the socialists. So can you talk about how they recognize the value of sports?
Yeah, I mean, again, they're kind of it's very similar to the church, but the socialists and the church are the two real main. They fueled the fire of sport in Italy throughout the 20th and by the 19th century as well. And their attitude is very similar to the church in that they're also terrified of it. They're terrified of this modern phenomenon for the same reason that the church was scared of sport. Apart from its worries about sort of Protestant sports, the church is really worried because it will distract people from piety. So, you know, we don't want people playing football because we'd much rather they come to church and pray. Now, the church realizes that this is if we carry on with this sort of blinkered approach, then we are just going to lose people. So the church adapts to it quite quickly. Socialism is terrified by it, and they don't know what to do about it. So they're worried about, for the same reasons, not a distraction from piety, but a distraction from the class struggle. If people are busy playing football, then they're not thinking about the class struggle. They're not thinking about their terrible social conditions. They're not thinking about how their class is being repressed by the capitalist class. And whilst we don't, I mean, that's, you know, basic sort of Marxist interpretations of sport. And I think in many ways, in the Italian case, it's a very valid argument. You see a number of industrial benefactors who form sports clubs across the world. And it seems to me that there's a certain strength to that argument. However, the thing that the socialists are they're far more blinkered than the church in their approach. And they have these huge polemics within the Italian Socialist Party, particularly around just the pre-First World War period. And there's this huge divide amongst the Socialist Party, amongst those people who are completely in favour of sport, those complete people who are completely opposed to sport on ideological grounds, and those people who are kind of worried about it but think, well, but I can see there's a positive here. And as a result of these arguments, they never get to the bottom of it. They never really come up with a solution. They're terrified by the sales that the Gazzetta dello Sport has. It sells far more than any socialist newspaper. For every one socialist newspaper, you might see 50 Gazzetta dello Sports fly off the newsstands in, you know, the early 1900s. And they are very worried about it. But what I think is interesting, what I've argued in the book, is that actually out of these arguments that the church and the Socialist Party make, and their polemics and their discussions about the merits and the negatives, and they effectively write a blueprint for fascism. I don't think fascism is particular. I mean, it's very smart because they come along and just take these arguments and just put them into place. So all the negatives and all the ways in which the church said, well, this is a real worry because we're going to lose piety. What they're saying is sport mobilizes. Socialists are saying the same thing. Sport can mobilize people more than politics can, more than religion can. So what the regime thinks is, well, okay, we'll get out of sport. So I think they look at their arguments and just see this is the obvious mass cultural phenomenon, which if we can get hold of it and direct it, then we've got a winner. So they're very different. Their approach is very different, the socialists and the church, but I think for their fears are exactly the same. But the church is far more practical and prepared to embrace it because it sees the potential, what it can actually achieve. Whereas the socialists are still, Carlo Levi, who wrote, the author wrote, Christ Stopped at Air Bully. And he writes an article in, I think it's the late 30s. He's been in prison, I believe, at this point. He's writing under a pseudonym in the midst of the regime. And he's still writing an article about idiotic working classes are obsessed by people running around on a bouncing ball. So in the midst of the height of consensus for the regime, the socialists are still having this argument about the merits of sport. Now, you know, excuse me, but it's a little bit late to be having this discussion now because there's more pressing issues like the complete destruction of your civil liberties. But they're still going on about it.
And I was going to ask about that. I was going to turn to the fascist period. And you know, when we look at sport in Europe in the 1930s, we see all these examples of the meshing of politics and sport, whether in Nazi Germany or in the Soviet Union. And it's really, though, in Italy with Mussolini's regime that you see for the first time a government making sport part of its program, part of its political program, correct? And so I was going to ask about that. You might want to talk a bit more about why was it that Mussolini came upon this idea of using sport for political purposes?
I mean, he's the innovator. I mean, everybody kind of knows that people who don't study sport history, everybody kind of knows about the Nazi Olympics, mm-hmm. and we got an idea about the Soviet Union used in the post Second World War period. Mussolini's the instigator of it. He's the first one, and I think it's partly because, as I say, the blueprint's been written by the socialists and the Catholics. They literally write them a plan, and it's painfully obvious what the socialists and the Catholics do. Is they generate enormous interest in sport. So they run clubs, they have associations, they publicise it, they have tournaments, competitions, but in the midst of it, they're still not sure. So they create a massive interest in it, developing upon its natural development in this period anyway. And then having done that, they actually nonetheless fail to completely seize control of this phenomenon. So you've created a monster, effectively. Now, if someone can come along and actually direct that, then they've got something very powerful. Now, Mussolini has lots of influences of people like Gustave Le Bon, the French crowd theorist, and he's quite, he's been thinking about this anyway in terms of his general politics. But if you look at big sporting events, what have you got? You've got big crowds. So the regime has a huge number of reasons for taking control of sport. I think the masses is one for sure. I mean, the fact that it has mass appeal, it connects with its it's not class exclusive. It appeals to everybody. Some form of sport can appeal to everybody. Everybody will have some. It will touch upon people's lives in some way, even if they hate sport. They'll still probably defend. They'll probably defend and explain why they hate it so much. So even if they don't like it, you can. There's an angle. It reinforces the regime. Uses it to reinforce gender roles. It's about the regime's demographic campaign. So it's about increasing the fitness of Italians. Italians who are going to go and fight in colonial wars. Italians who are going to fight. Who are going to fight metaphorically in the factories. Women who are going to fight the battles. The battle for births. So the fitter and stronger we get women, the more babies they'll have and the fitter babies they'll have. So there's a fascist angle on every sport, and every sport can contribute to almost all policies of the regime. And ultimately, I think it's a really fundamental part of the regime's whole drive to mass mobilise. But Mussolini's big problem is that he can't obviously appeal to mass society, the working class, this sort of emergent dominant force in Italian politics of the working class. It can't appeal to the working class on a class basis, because it has come to power through the destruction of socialist trade unions and through repression of the working class. So it can't appeal to the working class on a class basis, but it needs the consent of the working class, or at least its sort of benevolent neutrality. So they have to be mobilised. And what better way of mobilising people than sport? Because you can do so not on a class basis. So you can mobilise them either on through their profession. You could mobilise them through their age. So you could have youth groups, the Opera Nazionale Balilla. You could do adult groups, the Opera Nazionale Dopo Lavoro, the after work movement for adult people. You could do it on the basis of local or national identities. So it appeals to all different sectors of Italian society. It gives you an option to get into the lives of all sectors of Italian society, but not on a class basis. And I think that's, and that's part of a wider cultural exploitation by the regime. It's not only sport. I think sport is enormously important, but it goes through to art, through to music, to architecture, the regime uses culture to try to mobilize society and get society behind it.
So let me follow up on that. You had said the socialists and the Catholics, while they both wanted, they saw the value of using sport, they were also wary of sport going beyond their control. And so thinking of the fascists as the first totalitarian regime, and you know the fascists invented the term totalitarian as their aim, how successful was Mussolini's regime in controlling sport? Or do you see instances where sport kind of slipped beyond their control?
I mean, I think there's a big debate about how totalitarian the regime was anyhow.
Yeah.
But in terms of sport, I mean, it depends how you want to evaluate it. It has almost total, I think it's possibly one of the few areas of Italian life where it does have totalitarian control, above all, because the church isn't really that interested in it anyway. So there is nothing to rival its control over sport. It crushes any oppositional sort of youth and sporting clubs, and it eventually even gets around to sort of doing that to the church, or it takes over church sort of youth groups. So it does have almost complete totality. There is no opposition to fascist sporting societies. If you want to have anything to do with sport, be it as a spectator, as a participant, as a kid, you've got to go through the party. So I think it's very successful in its total rule and control of sport. That said, does it reap the rewards of mobilizing society? I would say probably not, because when the time comes, you don't see a nation which has been mobilized and stands up and wants to defend the fascist regime. So whilst it has totalitarian control or total control over sport, I'm not sure that has the impact. And ultimately, there's still always the opportunity that these big events can offer for opposition as well. So you do see the odd moment of potentially oppositional activity, but the big point around sport is this whole issue of what does it mean to consent? How do we judge consent? How do we evaluate it? Because somebody goes to the football match, because they support the Italian national team that wins the World Cup in 34 and 38, does that mean they're a fascist? Or does that mean they just support their country? I don't think the regime in many ways actually cares too much. But in terms of determining whether the impact upon society, I think it's very difficult to call, other than when the moment comes and the Second World War comes along and the regime collapses, you don't see an enormous amount of people who actually want to stand up and defend it. There are many, of course, and they're still there, and unfortunately they're growing. So the neo-fascist presence is increasing considerably in Italy at the moment, and that has a... You don't have to look too far in Italy to find somebody who is who will defend the regime, who will look at what they consider to be many positive aspects of the regime. The recent elections are indicative of that. A minimum of at least half a dozen neo-fascist parties on the list. So I think it's difficult to say that sport, or the extent to which sport does mobilise people. It certainly has a major impact, because it's everywhere.
Simon, one of my favorite parts of the book was your discussion of the development of Ferrari and mm-hmm. Vespa. And
right.
Can you talk about those? So you talk about not only sporting culture, but motor culture as part of sporting culture. So can you talk about the development of those two vehicles and how they fit into the post-war economic development?
Yeah, I mean, they're real. They are real. They're the real symbols of Italy. I mean, when I sort of teach this sport and Italian history course, my students, one of the first things I ask them, what do you associate with Italy? And beyond pizza and ice cream, it's Ferrari, and maybe football, and sort of Vespa. These are sort of iconic images of Italy, and they emerge. They are products of the economic boom, of the miracle of 1958. To 63, which effectively is thanks to Marshall Plan money. So it's sort of an anti-communist funded boom. It's promoting the sort of merits of capitalism in Italy. Italy's a very key Cold War country because of its border with Yugoslavia. So the West is horrified of the prospect of an Italian state which might even democratically vote to become communist, and the Communist Party does become the largest communist party in Western Europe. So there's good reason for sort of Western capitalist society to have concerns about that. So the boom partly comes from this huge amount of money. It also comes because of the incredibly large reservoir of labour resources which are down in the south of Italy. So huge amounts of people who are unemployed and very poor. And they move and they offer the cheap labour that the boom thrives on in the northern cities of Milan, Turin and Genoa, and particularly factories like Fiat, for example, and like the Piaggio factory, which makes the Vespa. And what you see is that the Vespa is really, it's kind of, you know, it's indicative of a society which is modernizing, but in a society which a working class, which finally begins to have some disposable income. And so we see the boom in Italy is really built on electrodomestics, so washing machines, refrigerators. People are able to, there a huge amount of them are exported, but people are able to buy these televisions. They've got money to spend. And the other area that they now are spending on is transport. But what we need for the economic boom is we need a means of transport which is suitable, appropriate for the time. So it's got to be cheap. It's got to be able to get you around. But it's got to be cheap to buy, cheap to run, cheap to insure. And that's effectively what the Vespa does. And it has the impact that the bicycle had, an absolute revolution in the sort of mid-late 19th century in Italy. It's the same impact as that, but it's on two wheels and it's motorised. And so it enables people to get to work, to travel longer distances to work. It also gives them the opportunity to get away, to get out into the countryside. You can put your girlfriend on the back now and get her out into the countryside where your deeply conservative Catholic parents can't see you. It encourages the stimulation of the tourist boom in this period. People can finally get out to the sea. They can get to the mountains. Now, the Vespas, obviously one of the great success stories of Italian manufacturing, but what it can't do is one of the few things it can't do is it can't keep you dry when it's raining. You can get an entire family on a Vespa. If you go down to Naples and Palermo, you can still see that, you know, wife, husband, two kids, the cat and the dog, plus the shopping. You can do that, but it doesn't keep you dry. So we need in this period something similar, affordable, cheap to run, doesn't cost a lot in petrol, doesn't cost a lot in insurance, good in the cities. And that's the Fiat 500, the classic car of the boom, the little Fiat that everybody comes to associate with Italy. And again, this is what happens, is we see that this creates it's also a smart move by the automobile industry, because they create a new sector of consumer. These people who previously couldn't afford a car, it was a middle class luxury. So let's make a car that the working classes or the sort of slightly better off working classes can afford. They will then buy that. So we create our own market. Now, if you do that, then obviously what this does is, whereas the car or the bicycle, we go right back again to the bicycle, the Vespa, the Fiat 500, these are all means of also distinguishing yourself socially. So you can make yourself stand out as somebody who has done well for themselves, has disposable income, you can afford a car. So it's a status symbol. Now, if everybody can now afford a car, then suddenly that status symbol is no longer a status symbol. So what do we do? What does the higher end of the market do? All we start to do is produce expensive cars. You can still show your wealth, but you can differentiate yourself, not because you've got a car, but because of the type of car. So we then start seeing Alfa Romeo and Fiat concentrate on the popular market, and Alfa and Ferrari begin producing high-end, top-of-the-range, luxury, very, very expensive cars. And as a result of that, what they do is that they enter Grand Prix racing, and that's effectively what Grand Prix racing is all about. I mean, it's not what it is today in this huge sort of money-making jamboree and what some people like to refer to as a sport. It's a means of selling your car. And that's, if you go back to the fascist period, the Mille Miglia, the 1,000-mile touring race from Brescia down to Rome and back, it's about showing car reliability. It's about marketing your product. And that's what Grand Prix racing is about. And Ferrari creates a Grand Prix team as a means of getting it, publicising its car across the world. So really, from the boom, out of the boom, we see people having money to spend across all classes. And cars are ways of people distinguishing their social class and showing their difference.
Simon, we do need to talk about Italian football. And the one thing I want to ask about is I want to jump ahead to the 1990 World Cup. And and something you discuss is that the 1990 World Cup hosted by Italy was not a moment of triumph for Italy, but as a case study in Italian mismanagement and corruption. So could you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's... What we see is, I mean, it's not a triumph in the sense that they really should win it, and they don't, and they blow it. So in that sense, it doesn't become a triumph. As I argue, it's very indicative of the sort of political, it's the first signs of the political corruption storm that's going to be coming, of Tangentopoli, into which breaks really 92 onwards. And what we see is that Italia 90 is... it's a lesson in corruption. We see projects, state money provided for projects associated with the World Cup in towns what have nothing to do with the World Cup, which are not hosting. We see developments in sort of just payments between direct payments from the state into private companies with no sort of intermediary. There's no sort of controls over the budget in many ways. So there's an enormous amount of people which profit from that. We see a lack of sort of health and safety regulations amongst these companies, and a lot of workers get killed, 20, 30 more workers, and get killed in the process of building the various stadiums. Huge amounts of injuries. But ultimately, there's an enormous amount of money being made by people who have got nothing to do with the World Cup. And it's very much indicative of the way that Italy has worked up until this point, and it's a kind of indicative of the way that bribery and corruption have become have taken over Italian life by this point. And it's indicative of the political storm that's going to come 2 years later.
The year the Italians do win the World Cup, 2006. So I'm presuming you were there for the celebrations.
I was in Rome on my scooter, along with about 2 million other people, watching bins being burnt and buses being hijacked, basically. And it was pretty extreme, I got to say. I mean, I'm English, and I don't know what we would do here. God forbid England never won the World Cup. I think we'd probably go and recolonize a country to celebrate. But there, it was just complete chaos. I mean, the rules of the road are bad enough on a good day, but it was total chaos.
Well, I want to ask you about, because you describe, you know, the destruction of the celebrations aside, you say that, and I can't remember the term you use, but there was something sordid about the whole atmosphere surrounding Italy's win in the World Cup in 2006. And it was, part of it was all of the other events in Italian football in 2006. So so could you talk about that and that year in Italian football?
Yeah, I mean, the World Cup win in 2006 comes on the back of the breaking of a story in about April of that year, so very, very close to the tournament, of arguably the biggest corruption scandal. And I say arguably because there have been many, and there's a huge one since then, in Italian football. Italian football is revealed to have been completely corrupt. And as many people had argued for many, many years, and I won't make many friends here in this statement, but it has been corrupted by Juventus, effectively. And that will upset a lot of people. But to be fair, it's not only Juventus which are found to be involved in this. Lazio have an involvement. Fiorentina have an involvement as well. And Milan are also, AC Milan are also up to no good as well. So it's not only Juventus, but it does, as the investigation reveals, and many people still like to dispute this, or many Juventus fans like to dispute it, but it reveals a system being organised by Luciano Moggi, who's the managing director of Juventus. And this is this whole scandal, which breaks in April of 2006, just before the World Cup. And it does tarnish the victory, very much so. The rest of the world is quite critical, is very critical of Italy. It sees Italy as just a nation of cheats. I experienced it. It was quite interesting as a Brit in Italy. I was supporting Italy completely, and speaking with people back home. I think it was by the quarterfinal stage. People were saying, "Well, back in England, everybody I spoke to was like anybody but Italy. Like, as long as Italy doesn't win it, anybody." And that included Argentina, Germany and France, the teams and the countries that as a Brit we really hate. You know, there's nothing worse than an Argentine, because they want our islands back. But nonetheless, everybody supported those in front of the Italians, because the Italians have this now reputation of being so corrupt and so dirty, and which partly is unfair, but also partly is obviously quite justified. And that resounded also within Italy, because the celebrations were very muted, because within a week or so of the victory and these enormous celebrations in Rome, the results of the inquiry were released, and it just left a very bad taste in everybody's mouth. And there was a sense that, yeah, we've won the World Cup, but it was just such a total corruption of the national passion of Italian football. And it left a bad taste, and unfortunately, it hasn't gone away.
We're almost out of time, Simon, and we do need to ask about Berlusconi. And what I want to ask you is, as someone who's researched Italian football, who's been living in Italy for over a decade, what would be the one thing that we really need to know about Berlusconi that might be missed by most media accounts of him?
Good question. The one thing, in terms of sport, I think the one thing that everybody should know is that it's just his total domination of the media, and as prime minister, he's total dominated. As prime minister, he had control effectively over state media, and he controlled an enormous amount of the private media through his TV channels, where he shows Milan, where he can raise the value of advertising space. If you want to put an advert on when he's great, and it is a great Milan side of the sort of early mid-1990s of Hullet, Van Basten, Rijkaard, you want to put an advert on during one of those matches, it goes on his channel, and you design your advert through his advertising agency. So it's this huge money-making machine for him. And that is one... I think that's arguably one of the biggest challenges that Italy actually has, is that they must introduce a conflict of interest legislation, and it goes beyond sport. They must do that, and if they can actually manage to put a government together, which at the moment seems very unlikely, they must do that, because it's wrong. It's quite simply wrong, and he has exploited it in a frighteningly effective way, which is where the source of his power comes from. There are just such limited opportunities for alternative voices through the Italian media. And it's wrong. And football has been a major part of his sort of electoral appeal, but ultimately his control of the media is the crux of the problem.
Simon, the last chapter of your book is titled "Not a Normal Country." What do you mean by that?
Lots of things, really, but in many ways it could have been perhaps not a natural country. I think it's not Italy as where we started. In many ways, it's not a natural country. It's not a natural nation. I think its obsession, or the role of sport in Italy, is I think it's different. It's difficult to make that, because there aren't really too many comparable works of other nations, and I'd certainly love other people to start writing similar types of histories of other countries. I would love to see a history of Germany written in this way. Then we can make comparisons, and perhaps it would be proven to be maybe I'll be shown to be wrong. But I think Italy isn't normal because I think sport does have a an above average sort of measure of importance within Italian society. But the key difference, I think, between Italy and other countries, people would say to me, well, all sports are politicized. And, you know, all sports get used by various agencies and whatever. Yeah, okay, they do. But I think the big difference in Italy and the big problem, the reason in many ways why this book is written is because I think the one thing that you don't hear about throughout the book almost completely is the state. You don't hear about, there's very little written about the Italian government, the state. Because the state, like many other aspects of Italian life, and particularly the legal system in the early and law enforcement in the early years of the country, the state doesn't take responsibility for sport. So sport is always in the hands of private bodies, private agencies, who can then direct it and politicize it. Now, if sporting provision from the beginning had been offered adequately by the state, then there would have been no vacuum for the church to come in and exploit. There would have been no vacuum for the Socialist Party to exploit. There would have been no vacuum for the Fascist Party to exploit it, because the state would have been there providing that. And that's where I think that you would probably see a big difference between Italy and other countries. But it's not normal for a variety of reasons. I think, you know, the identity is a key one, and that's the real sort of modern, the current issue, the difficulties of race, the difficulties that Mario Balotelli throws up in terms of this identity of what it actually means to be Italian. And it's a very, very, we talk about Italy as this country, and everybody knows what a great country is, what a beautiful country is, what product, what it can produce. But then it's just so fractured, and it so doesn't know what it is. And I don't think it kind of ever really will do it. All it knows is what it isn't. And that's what I think makes it a really unusual place. It makes it a great place, but it also creates a number of many of the issues and the problems that it has to face up to.
So after 11 years in Rome, so I know you're a West Ham supporter. Have you adopted a team in Serie A?
Yeah, of course. There's only one team in Serie A. That's Roma. You can't support any other side. AC Milan's run by Berlusconi. Juventus are completely crooked. Inter, let's leave it. I tried Fiorentina because I was there for a year, and I saw Fiorentina a lot, but I just couldn't love them. So there's only one team in Italy. Okay. And of course, you can't support Lazio for obvious reasons.
You've been listening to an interview with Simon Martin about his book, Sport Italia, The Italian Love Affair with Sport, published by IB Toris in 2011. New Books in Sports is part of the New Books Network, which offers dozens of channels of podcast interviews with the authors of new publications on subjects like world music, science and technology, and terrorism and organized crime. If you like what you heard here, please follow New Books in Sports on Twitter or friend us on Facebook. You can give us your feedback, offer suggestions, and find links to thoughtful sports writing from around the world. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. Thank you for listening, and enjoy your week.